U.S., the expansion of bases in his country. I think it's great. You just said, you know, we can expect to see new faces rise up, and I hope that we do. Chavez, you know, he won most of the elections with a landslide, pretty much, in comparison, of course, to U.S. elections, but a closer margin than ever before with the most recent one. Do you think that this could be signifying some sort of political shift in the country?
Well, the tides are changing a bit. The opposition has definitely gained some steam, and even within his own party, Chavez received a bit of criticism because it was more of a top-down populist movement, because he was just this larger-than-life character, as opposed to it kind of growing through the grassroots. However, in the wake of his passing, we now see that the government is really banding together. And the beauty of the Chavez movement, unlike the Cuban Revolution, is that there are different factions. You have people with economic interests. You have the old school leftists that preceded this Chavismo. You have the Chavistas, of course. And then you have social groups. And a lot of them are comprised of the poor, people of color, those of African and indigenous descent. So that's kind of the beauty of it. And they're going to find their way through it. Maduro seems to right now have the support. He's leading in all the polls. And as you mentioned, the Carter Center really verified the veracity of those polls as well. So it's a shift, but I think there's still a possibility for it to keep going.
It'll be very interesting to see what happens. Thank you so much for coming on Breaking It Down, Jamelia Aisha Brown.
People come up. Turn the bass up on this one. Check it. Since 1516, minds attacked and overseen. Now crawl amidst the ruins of this empty dream. With their borders and boots on top of us, pulling out on the floor of the toxic metropolis. But how you gonna get what you need to get? The gut eaters, blood drenched, get offensive like that. The fifth sunset, get back, proclaim. The spirit of Guatemala, alive and untamed. Now face the fog, now blasting out your speaker. One on one.
Listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that was Rage Against the Machine with People of the Sun. And just to speak to one point that was made last clip on RT, really what this whole notion that the opposition is gathering strength in Venezuela and is poised to take power, and just because it like won more of a percentage of the vote in the last presidential election, that just doesn't bear out in terms of the facts on the ground. Basically, the opposition is hated in Venezuela by the vast majority of people. It's understood to basically be a puppet of the United States and Western imperialism, and to be funded majorly by Western corporate interests. And that's one of the reasons why when it during the state elections, which like virtually no one ever talks about, it seems, in these conversations that have been had over the last few days surrounding the death of Chavez, it's never really mentioned the fact that in the state elections that were held last fall in Venezuela, the opposition got destroyed. Absolutely destroyed. I mean, in virtually every one of the states, there are basically pro-Chavez parties in power now. Virtually every one of the state elections in Venezuela. I think that says a few things about the popularity of the Bolivarian Revolution. The fact that that kind of electoral victory is possible. You know, so I think the revolution is going to be just fine. It's going to go ahead. Maduro is going to take the helm. And there's going to be continuity here. And that in itself is a triumph. It's not about one man. It's about a movement. And we need to keep that in mind. So Back in the USSR is going to be back in a few minutes.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3.
Ever wonder what that weird sport is you turn on at 4 in the morning? The one where they kick the ball or bop the ball with their hands to other players? You know, the one where they wear really short shorts and try to get the ball through a group of four uprights? Wonder what those poles are at Margaret Green Cricket Pitch in Guelph are for? Well, it's Australian rules football, and Guelph has a team. The Guelph Gargoyles are recruiting for the 2013 season, and if you're interested in getting in shape for free, experiencing a different sport for all skill types, and meeting a very tight-knit community of great people, well, check out www.guelphgargoylesafc.com for more information. The team is open to anyone over the age of 16. No experience is necessary and no one is turned away. We train Tuesdays and Thursdays with Saturday games. Or if you're interested in checking us out, join us on May 11th for our preseason tournament and every other Saturday starting at noon at Margaret Green Park in Guelph to see the team play. Spice up your Saturdays with the Guelph Gargoyles Australian Rules Football and GuelphGargoylesAFC.com.
For the latest adventures in modern music, listen to Sounds from the Tall House with your host, Michael Mucci. Every other Sunday from 10 a.m. to 12 noon, right here on CFRU 93.3 FM.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I volunteer at CFRU because it's a space that really encourages creativity and expressing yourself.
My name is Stacy. I love discovering music that sounds good to me. All kinds of music.
I love the people, I love the atmosphere, and everyone loves radio, and you can tell.
If you love radio and would like to get involved, volunteer at CFRU. No previous experience is required, and we provide all the training. Check out our website at cfru.ca or call Christopher at 519-824-4120, extension 58341, or email volunteer at cfru.ca.
Volunteering at CFRU breeds minds, breeds culture. So come on down.
Okay, you're back. I'm back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM in Guelph, and we're continuing our tribute to, of course, the late Hugo Chavez, a true revolutionary hero who led his country for 14 years on the path of 21st century socialism. So we're going to continue. This is a report which was done by Joshua Blakeney of Press TV, and it's quite an interesting report which he gave on Hugo Chavez, democracy, and the hypocrisy of the neocons. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Talking about Venezuelan and Cuban emigres in North America, you know, who has
even Syrian, you know, pro-terrorist Syrians, anti-Assadists.
So like Syrians who serve the Zionist interests, for example, in Syria.
And Iranians who do the same, you know?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, I think it's always a problem with these revolutions that emerge in the global south that you have the opponents of them ensconced in Harvard University, in California universities, in Princeton, with perfect English, who come on our media and they look like us, sound like us, act like us, and so they can ingratiate themselves with the audience much easier. Chavez was a peasant. He didn't speak English. He came from the working class, just like President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is in Iran. He's a man who comes from the lower classes in Iranian society. And I mean, you mentioned foreign policy. I think this was one of Hugo Chavez's big crimes. He sided with the Lebanese resistance. He supported Lebanon in its attempts to extirpate Israel when it illegally invaded Lebanon in 2006. Chavez expelled the Israeli ambassador from Venezuela, and Canada turned over the Canadian embassy to become a de facto Israeli embassy. Chavez offered citizenship to stateless Palestinians. Chavez sided with Iranian self-determination and Iran's right to create a peaceful nuclear energy program. He supported Syria's sovereignty and the right of the Syrian state to fight enemies foreign and domestic. And that was one of his big crimes. And it's very interesting after his death that the Zionists, who are replete in Canada's media, Zionist journalists in Canada's media, are attacking Chavez and calling him an anti-Semite and all the rest of it. And it's very funny because the neocon discourse, of course, is that we should use U.S. power, or U.S. power should be utilized to impose democracy and to promote democratization. But yet, when Hugo Chavez implemented a democratic revolution in Venezuela, and no one can dispute that he put himself to the electorate a dozen times, Jimmy Carter, who's not a well-known radical or revolutionary, Jimmy Carter, the former U.S. president, his Carter Center evaluated and oversaw the elections in Venezuela, and he described it, I believe, as one of the best elections that he'd ever seen, or the most perfect electoral processes that he'd ever viewed. And so you have the former US president calling a perfect electoral process a democratic revolution, and yet you have these neocons who claim they're against dictators, who claim they're for democratization, opposing and conspiring against the Bolivarian Revolution. That indicates to me that these neocons, most of whom are hardcore supporters of the State of Israel, these neocons don't support democracy. They want slave governments. If it's a dictatorship like in Saudi Arabia, then so be it. And if it's an elected slave governments, as is the case in Canada, then so be it too. Although our electoral process is disputed, isn't it, Aaron? Because we had the election fraud scandal in 2011. So what happens in our society is that stones are thrown in glass houses. We have election fraud in our society, and yet we throw stones at Venezuela, which has, according to the former US President Jimmy Carter, a perfect electoral system, the best his entity had ever seen, the Carter Center. I think, isn't it a case of almost social Darwinism, that us the white people must be perfect, our system must work, we couldn't learn anything from those darkies in the global south, those brown skinned people, they couldn't do anything better than us. But yet you and I are standing just in front of a bunch of oil skyscrapers here behind us, and you're basically telling me, Aaron, that we could learn something from Hugo Chavez. We could learn something in our society where our oil resources, our oil profits, they don't go to schools and hospitals and university. Chavez created the fifth largest student body in the world, the fifth largest, whereas our students, so now young people aren't going to university because they have to shoulder tens of thousands of dollars of debt. So our oil profits aren't being redistributed, as is the case in Venezuela.
So that was Joshua Blake in his report, of course, on Hugo Chavez. And, of course, he brings up quite a few points there. Obviously, when he's talking about, you know, the quote-unquote crimes that Chavez is accused of committing, you know, by the West and by really the global capitalist system, you know, and the neocons and all that whole crowd. You know, the crimes are basically supporting these, not only standing up to U.S. imperialism himself and Western imperialism, but also supporting other states that have been supporting, been opposing Western imperialism. You know, supporting Libya, supporting Syria, supporting Iran, you know, all these, and supporting Iraq, you know, back in the day. Because, of course, he's been around long enough to have done that as well. So, I mean, it's, you know, he has really taken a leadership position in that regard. And of course, that's unforgivable to the global elite, who, of course, you know, don't want any sort of challenge to their imperialist agenda and to their profit motive. So, of course, Chavez was a major barrier to them. You know, absolutely major barrier to them. The revolution which he led, of course, major barrier to them. You know, in more ways than one. Of course, we're going to get more into that as we go forward. But I mean, when we're talking about how one of the points which he brought up very, very well is that, you know, these right wing causes that you see in the third world, whether that's like, you know, these so called rebels who emerged in, who were really just tribalists and Islamists and pro capitalist elements in Libya, who of course devastated that country. You know, they portrayed themselves as freedom fighters in the mainstream media. And the reason why they were able to really do that is because they had spokespeople in the West who could speak perfect English, who could like really connect with the people in the West, in Western audiences, in a way that, say, Muammar Gaddafi could not. And they said they had the same thing in Venezuela, where like a lot of these upper class Western educated people in the Venezuelan elite, who of course hate Chavez and what he stands for, you know, end up going to the West and like, you know, basically talking smack about Chavez and basically saying how, you know, he's this evil guy, he's an evil dictator, and, you know, in perfect English on mainstream American TV. Meanwhile, of course, like Chavez himself is, you know, is basically a proletarian. He's of the working class background. He never learned how to speak English, you know. And, you know, so he cannot do that. He cannot, like, communicate to the English-speaking world in the same way the opposition can, which, of course, is pro-American and pro-West and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, and that's a problem. That's a problem that he's recognized, in fact. And that's probably one of the reasons why the Venezuelan government has really been pushing its population to learn English now, so that they say more proletarian Venezuelans can actually communicate, tell the story in their own words to the Western media, you know, in English, so that the opposition, the right-wing pro-American opposition, does not have a monopoly on discourse about Venezuela in the Western media. You know, that's one of the reasons why he wants Venezuelans to learn English, so that, you know, these ordinary working-class Venezuelans can tell their story. And there's not this kind of, like, misinformation that gets spread in the Western media. So that's, like, very, very important. So I'm going to play another clip right now about going forward. So this is why the U.S. government, frankly, hates Chavez, considering the big oil interests and that sort of thing. This is on the Real News Network.
Welcome to the Real News Network. I'm Paul Jay in Baltimore. On Tuesday, President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela died, as most of our viewers know now. Now joining us to discuss the significance of his life and the meaning of his death is Greg Palas. Greg's an investigative journalist. He's worked for the BBC. He's written for The Nation magazine, Rolling Stone. He's the author of the new bestseller, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. Thanks for joining us again, Greg.
Glad to be with you, Paul.
Well, first of all, let's talk about your connection with Chavez. You made at least one or two films about Chavez. You got to know him personally. What were your impressions?
Well, I was assigned by BBC television to find out who this guy was and why the U.S. wanted to kill him. Pat Robertson made the statement on the air, Hugo Chavez thinks, you know, we're trying to kill him and we ought to just go and do it. And for the simple reason that Reverend Robertson made, which is that Hugo Chavez is sitting on the world's largest pool of oil. It's bigger now. The Venezuelan reserves are actually bigger than those of Saudi Arabia. No one's close. And therefore, the U.S. oil companies, the British oil companies, French oil companies, want to know why Venezuelans are sitting on top of their oil and won't give it away to them.
But Chavez does sell oil to the United States. Venezuela is one of the main suppliers of oil to the United States. And while there was a lot of rhetoric against the United States from President Chavez, they never did stop selling oil to them.
No, Chavez never wanted to stop selling oil to the U.S. His nation would die if it didn't sell oil. The idea that Chavez would ever threaten to remove oil is ridiculous. But what the U.S. oil companies and the big oil companies around the world didn't like is that Chavez wouldn't give the stuff away. Chavez sells Venezuelan crude oil. As of last week, it was about $101 a barrel. That's $33 a barrel more than the Canadians sell their heavy oil for, the same type of oil that Chavez sells. Which is, by the way, as I mentioned on your program before, the reason we haven't that the Koch brothers in the U.S. is pushing for this so-called XL Keystone pipeline. It's all about trying to get oil at a cheaper price than Chavez will sell it. And Chavez wouldn't sell it cheaply because he uses that money extraordinarily, unusually, as for the Venezuelan people. it's just unheard of that a big oil nation uses their money from oil to give to the people.
Right. Now, in terms of what you've seen so far, American media's reaction to the death of President Chavez, actually, in one of the other interviews, I'm going to show this again. Here's the New York Times just hours after President Chavez's death. And the headline is Chavez dies, leaving a bitterly divided Venezuela. And my comment was, we can put that down now. My comment was, and tell me exactly which country isn't bitterly divided. The United States is this great harmonious paradise, and especially an oil country. Yeah, you're going to have a division over who gets to use the oil wealth.
Actually, I completely disagree. It's not a bitterly divided nation. Chavez was overwhelmingly reelected several times. I've been all over the United States covering elections here and all over Venezuela and all over many nations covering elections. Venezuela is actually one of the least divided nations on the planet. The Chavez administration was unbelievably popular.
Yeah, but
the Carter Center. Yeah. The Carter Center is funded by this guy Cisneros, who is a Venezuelan opponent of Chavez. Even the Carter Center says that no one's ever accused Chavez of stealing an election. He's very, very, very popular there. He was popular. His party's popular for a simple reason. As one of his opponents told me, a broadcaster, she said, well, you know, Chavez gives bread and bricks to the people, you know, because they used to live in shanties. They now live in real houses. They were starving. Now they have food. They had no medicine. Now they have, you know, Chavez care beats Obamacare by a mile. So of course they vote for him. And she said that with disgust, like, you know, how dare he give the oil money to the poor people? But that's what he did. So it's not a divided nation. You could say it's divided 75-25. But
Well, we could argue about this because I think it may be more like the way the vote breaks down, which is maybe 55-60 was the supporting Chavez, and you could have 30-40% that were opposed, which here, I mean, United States, who knows? I mean, a lot of people don't vote, and it's maybe 50-50. But I think you're right. I mean, clearly he won election after election and he had majority support. But that doesn't mean there wasn't a lot of bitter opposition to him. And not only from just the rich. There were, you know, I've been in Caracas quite a few times. And, you know, there was opposition even at levels in the working class, in the middle class. But I take your point. The majority of people clearly supported Chavez and what he was doing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are always those who felt that the revolution that as he called it, didn't go far enough. So there's always a big opposition from the left, and young people were chafing. They want a new world. They hadn't had the deprivations of their parents. But, you know, he was a popular guy.
Talk a little bit about the American media reaction to his death. The level of venom is really something.
It's unbelievable. Both and what's amazing to me is it doesn't matter whether it's, the kind of Fox News stuff where you assume that the right wing will attack Chavez, and you'll assume Pat Robertson will attack Chavez. But you get this from the New York Times. You get this from PBS. And well, we know why PBS. Number one funder of the PBS is Chevron Corporation. I mean, they're the petroleum broadcast system, and they carry the oil company line. And the oil companies have always been just screaming angry about Hugo Chavez. And why? It's because of his hydrocarbon law. In 2001, he passed a law through the legislature that said that Venezuelans will no longer take 16% of the value of their oil and selling it abroad, but 30%. That's because they cut the first contracts and set the first royalties when oil was $10 a barrel. Now it's $100 a barrel. So they said, you know, some of that profit has to go to the people. Heavy oil in Venezuela was sold to foreign companies like Exxon at a 1% royalty. The Venezuelans got a penny out of the dollar of their own oil. He said, well, that changes to 16%. Now, there's another leader who did that named Sarah Palin in Alaska, who also raised royalties on the same U.S. oil companies by about the same amount. But no one said that Palin was a dictator. But in the case of Chavez, they say he's a dictator so that they can try to overthrow him.
Yeah, you can't read it. You couldn't over the last few years read a newspaper story, hardly a story, where the word dictator didn't get into the first paragraph when describing Chavez, in spite of the fact he would win election after election.
Yes,
But let me ask you something else.
This is, I think, an important example. You had a guy named Romero of the New York Times has an interview with Chavez, and he asks him, when are you going to give up power? Now, has he ever gone to Obama or to Bush and say, and Bush wasn't even elected, did he ever go to Bush, any New York Times reporter, and say, when are you going to give up power when you have an elected president in the middle of a term? And they kept calling him a strong man, an authoritarian, dictator-like, whatever that means. It's like Italian-like or something. And this is all about, in other words, he didn't go along with what the oil companies wanted. And they would say things like bitterly divided nation, destroyed the Venezuelan economy. The Venezuelan economy is increasing at about 5% this year, as it has been steadily for a few years. If I'll take that type of wreckage for the United States growing at 5% a year, and, he's done a tremendous job for the Venezuelan people. Now, look, I have my problems with Chavez. Chavez called me his friend. I said, no, I'm not your friend, because I'm not the friend of any politician. I don't care who they are. I don't want to be charmed. I don't want, they always disappoint me. They always break my heart. I'm here to report the story. And I told some stories that he and his crowd didn't like. But, I'm not going to join the New York Times crowd and talk about him as a dictator, a guy who won't give up power. They keep talking about him holding power. He's elected. And I got to tell you that there was a coup d'etat. Chavez was kidnapped. The New York Times reported that he had resigned from office. It was a lie. I was working for BBC Television and The Guardian. I stayed up all night to finally get a hold of Chavez's people who had heard from Chavez that he was kidnapped. He hadn't resigned. The New York Times, when I asked them, why did you run this story that he'd resigned? They said, well, because the State Department told us. And that's how the New York Times gets
it. I remember that moment. You were one of the only one or two journalists that actually tracked that story down. Everyone else either took it from the State Department or they took it from the Venezuelan media, who were actually in on organizing the coup.
That's right. The Venezuelan media were in on it. In fact, one thing I disagreed with Chavez is that he closed down one of the stations. But it was a few years after that coup attempt. But if any United States network, yours or Fox or anyone else, called for the violent overthrow of the Obama administration, said, kidnap the president, kill him, take over, I think he'd be shut down. It's violent overthrow of the government is punishable by death in our Constitution.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us, Greg.
You're very welcome.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
Me creo Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez, Rafael Correa, man. Evo Morales, Simón Bolívar, soy Salvador Allende, soy hip hop combatiente y rebelde. Me creo Fidel Castro, Hugo Chávez, Rafael Correa, man. Evo Morales, Simón Bolívar, soy Salvador Allende, soy hip hop combatiente y rebelde. Lo que pasó en Honduras, man, eso fue un golpe. Los gringos lo pagaron, man, dinero en el sobre. En Ecuador lo que intentaron fue un golpe que falló, le dieron golpes al golpe. Es tiempo que explique lo que pasa en mi tierra. Volvió la dictadura en la forma de Piñera. Él es un piraña que ataca a los mapuches. Por eso grito marichihueo para que escuchen. Esto pa' la CIA, men, sus manos están con sangre. Quítense el camuflaje, ustedes son cobardes. Los pobres tienen hambre y los ricos son almuerzo. Seamos Rafael Cancel en todos los congresos. Si todos somos Marcos, seamos como el Marco. Seamos zapatistas en nuestros propios barrios. Si no somos mentiras y solo somos rappers. El tiempo es ahora, hay que tomar action. Me creo Fidel Castro, Hugo Chávez, Rafael Correa, man. Evo Morales, Simón Bolívar, soy Salvador Allende, soy hip hop combatiente y rebelde. Me creo Fidel Castro, Hugo Chávez, Rafael Correa, man. Evo Morales, Simón Bolívar, soy Salvador Allende, soy hip hop combatiente y rebelde. Me creo comandante, fuerte y saludable. No hay cáncer que me mate, el proceso va pa'lante. Soy caminante,
parte del pueblo, consejos comunales organizando bases. Hace tu camino, controla tu destino, hacia una buena vida hay que vivirla digna. Las cifras indican un futuro difícil, misiles y guerras, más gente en pobreza. Deuda externa, bancos están en quiebra, de Gringolandia a Grecia, crisis de hipoteca. Fondo monetario, protege lo empresario, pero soy González Claudio, copiando Wells Fargo. Soy Castro, soy Chávez, pero al margen del gobierno. Soy célula durmiendo dentro del imperio, despierto en el momento preciso, creído porque creo en ese cambio que se vive a diario. Me creo Fidel Castro, Hugo Chávez, Rafael Correa, man. Evo Morales, Simón Bolívar, soy Salvador Allende, soy hip hop combatiente y rebelde. Me creo Fidel Castro, Hugo Chávez, Rafael Correa, man. Evo Morales, Simón Bolívar, soy Salvador Allende, soy hip hop combatiente y rebelde.
En fin, el retorno de Zaratustra. El retorno, en pleno retorno. Claro, Fidel me decía hoy, Chávez, es importante que el pueblo venezolano no crea que ya pasó todo. Es importante que tú mismo no te vayas a pensar que ya pasó todo. No, estamos en pleno proceso de una lucha que es dura y que lleva su tiempo. La vamos ganando y la ganaremos, pero lleva su tiempo y su ritmo.
Me creo Fidel Castro, Hugo Chávez, Rafael Correa, man. Evo Morales, Simón Bolívar, soy Salvador Allende.
So you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and that of course was Rebel Diaz with Mi Crio, and once again in tribute to Hugo Chavez, and which really this entire show has been about. But of course, I really want to talk about something that is also come up very, very recently, which is very important to talk about, I think. And what I mentioned before, of course, when it came to international solidarity and the importance of international solidarity and standing together against imperialism, I think this is kind of being lost in this really discourse that's been surrounding North Korea over the last week. I mean, I was really amazed, like even yesterday, you know, I'm sitting with my friends, like, you know, downtown Guelph, you know, we're at a restaurant. And, like, just everybody starts letting loose on North Korea and how stupid it is and how it's engaged in suicidal behavior and like, it's absolutely crazy and oh, yeah, like, the United States is going to wipe it off the map and stuff, or Japan's going to wipe it off the map, or all this kind of stuff. It's almost like, you know, you people know nothing about the Korean situation, and yet it seems like you're just jumping in with both feet making judgments and taking sides. And saying who's stupid and who is not stupid. And, like, you know, making all these kind of value statements and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's like it was absolutely terrible. It was a terrible experience for me. Just knowing as I do the situation in Korea and how it got started. And, like, really, and this, of course, really puts things in perspective. If you want to understand the dispute between America and North Korea as it stands right now. There was an agreement on the nuclear issue between America and North Korea back in the 1990s. It was made under the Clinton administration. And it basically said that North Korea would stop moving towards nuclear weapons. If sanctions were lifted from it, it was given access to oil, to the oil market, so it could buy fuel for itself. And if the United States would assist in shutting down the nuclear plants it already had, the old nuclear plants it had, that they were afraid were going to produce nuclear materials for a bomb, and if the United States would help build two new nuclear reactors that were light water reactors, you know, they couldn't produce fuel for a bomb. That was the agreement. They made that agreement in the 1990s, and everything was fine. Everything was peaceful. There was no escalation of tensions. There was a lot of reciprocity increasingly between North America and North Korea and South Korea. And, you know, it was going very well. Things were going smooth. There was none of this kind of escalation that we see recently, where it's almost on the brink of open war. Everything looked fine. And then, of course, George W. Bush came along. And almost as soon as he takes office, what did he do? He basically tore up that entire agreement. starts putting pressure on North Korea, sanctions, you know, naming it as part of the axis of evil. It's supposedly supporting terrorism, which, of course, is absolute nonsense. North Korea does not support terrorism. There's no evidence that it does. And yet it was placed on the list of state sponsors of terrorism by the United States. All this pressure is put on it. The agreement's torn up. And then, unsurprisingly, North Korea decides, in the name of self-defense, decides to move towards a nuclear bomb as an insurance policy so it doesn't get invaded by the United States. Because America has never invaded a country that is armed with nuclear weapons. That's a fact. And North Korea certainly doesn't want to be the next Yugoslavia or the next Iraq or the next Libya. You know, to get invaded and absolutely trashed by the American imperialism. They understand the writing on the wall. They have to defend themselves. So that's literally where we get to the point where we're at today. Where we're on the brink, where it looks like the Korean Peninsula tensions are escalated to such a great extent that we're almost on the brink of war. So I want to play again this entire thing could have been avoided if it weren't for the interest of U.S. imperialism, which once again pushed things to the brink. So once again, I want to play a clip on RT that was really, really good from a few weeks ago, which I played on the show, called North Korea is Not a Threat, because it's not. And we should stop pretending like it is.
Last month, North Korea announced that it will conduct a nuclear test in protest of the latest round of sanctions invoked against them. As a response, Secretary of State John Kerry and his counterpart in South Korea have made it very clear that it would be unacceptable for North Korea to proceed with testing their nuclear program. But this is nothing new. You see, in 2006 and 2009, North Korea issued two bomb tests despite international pressure and similar threats. And it all comes back to the same line, that North Korea is an imminent threat to the U.S. and its allies. That the big bad communist regime having control of a nuclear weapon is dangerous to the peace and stability of the world. But have you ever stopped to ask yourself, how much do we actually know about this country that we're being told to be so afraid of? Well, if you get all your information from the corporate news, you might think of this isolated nation as a rogue military state led by a teenage-like lunatic with a happy trigger finger ready to nuke the world. And no, I'm not going to sit here and tell you why North Korea is just some misunderstood stepchild that deserves praise. However, I think that there's a crucial point of view missing from the discussion. So let me give you a little background. The Korean Peninsula has a rich history that spans over 2,000 years, the vast majority of which it was a single unified country. But that all changed in 1945, when Korea became another victim of the emerging Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. At this time, the country was split in two, and neither side was given full control of the peninsula. In the north, a communist state was permanently established under the Soviets, a pro-Western state in the south. And what started then has played out for the last 60 years. Heightened tensions with hundreds of thousands of troops and missiles pointed at each other from the border. It's known as a demilitarized zone, although it remains the most heavily militarized area in the world. So to discuss North Korea's nuclear drive, its tense relations with the U.S., and the rationale of the harsh rhetoric coming from the international community, I'm joined now by National Coordinator for the Answer Coalition, Brian Becker.
Hi.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
So when Bush got into office, I think North Korea really came on the radar of a lot of Americans as the axis of evil, as part of the axis of evil. I mean, when did North Korea become one of America's targeted enemies, and why?
Well, the United States and 25 other nations invaded South Korea and then North Korea in 1950. And it was under the pressure of the North Korean army and the Chinese army, the volunteers, who came across the border in the fall of 1950, that the U.S. suffered its first military defeat. They were driven out of North Korea and down to what is now the demilitarized zone. So during that time, the North Koreans were presented as an existential threat. They were linked to China's communist revolution, which happened 1 year before that, part of the Soviet bloc. In other words, the U.S. Cold War narrative was the world was going communist. There was a series of revolutions or national liberation victories, and that Korea was at the epicenter of this global struggle.
And, I mean, what threat, if any, do they actually serve to this country?
Well, actually, North Korea doesn't pose any threat whatsoever. North Korea is a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's wanted for the past 60 years to have a peace treaty that ends the Korean War. The U.S. won't sign a peace treaty. Instead, the U.S. imposes economic sanctions on a small country. They want to have peace with the United States. Now, in the last months of the Clinton administration in 1999, 2000, Clinton opened the door to North Korea. Madeleine Albright, who was then Secretary of State, went to Pyongyang. It looked like there would be a thaw, perhaps a thaw between North and South Korea. As you mentioned in your opening, that's a country that's been divided, a country that had been united for thousands of years, divided so much so that 10 million families have missing people on the other side of the border. When that happened, North Korea suspended its nuclear program. When George W. Bush, when Clinton reached out to them, when Bush came in, he said, that's history. They're now the axis of evil along with Iraq and Iran. Bush invaded Iraq. That meant, that sent a clear message to the North Koreans. If you, like Iraq, are part of the axis of evil, and the U.S. invades Iraq, you're next. And that's when North Korea said, okay, we're going to go for nuclear weapons. They reopened the nuclear plants. They kicked out the IAEA inspectors. In other words, they were reacting defensively to Bush's threats.
You know, a lot of people don't realize that South Korea isn't necessarily a beacon of freedom here. I mean, we have this hard line against North Korea, how we need to spread democracy, human rights. I mean, talk about this hypocrisy a little bit.
Well, South Korea was a military dictatorship. Tens of thousands of people went to prison for long times. They were all tortured. That was under U.S. military occupation. The U.S. still has tens of thousands of U.S. troops in South Korea. It's an occupied country, just the way Iraq is or was. During that time, if you said anything nice about North Korea, if you said that was a good regime, you went to prison for 10 years. I went to North Korea in 1989. I traveled with a 21-year-old South Korean woman from North back to her home in South Korea. At the DMZ, she was arrested by U.S. soldiers and given 5 years hard labor for having dared to visit her relatives in North Korea. And the U.S. says, well, there's a bastion of democracy. Why? Because the U.S. uses South Korea as a puppet. It is an occupied country.
And I think a lot of people also think, you know, that South Koreans support the demilitarized zone, that they support the division. I mean, is this also propaganda? I mean, I'm sure the vast majority of them want to be reunited with lost family and friends on the other side.
You can't have a more emotional issue than the question of family division in Korea. The Korean people want to be united. They want to see their brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles. They've been separated now for 60 years. It happened suddenly at the beginning of the Korean War. Young Koreans especially have rejected the old hardline anti-communist fervor that was typical propaganda of the South Korean military. And you see lots of young South Koreans, especially people under the age of 30, they were the champions for democracy in South Korea. They are also the champions for reunification. That's a strong sentiment on both parts of the Korean peninsula.
Absolutely. I mean, it makes complete sense. You know, every week, Ryan, it seems like I'm reading something more insane about North Korea. You know, mass gulags, widespread starvation, cannibalism even. Or even the fact that the government claims that unicorns are real, but the more you look into these claims, the more it seems like they're kind of wildly exaggerated accusations taken out of context. I mean, is this all part of the plan to paint the country as just some out-of-control dictatorship to justify our military intervention?
When you opened your segment with Colin Powell testifying falsely at the UN about Iraq, we have to just remember what that was like. There was a demonization of the targeted government, Saddam Hussein. He was meant to be the exaggerated face of evil. Everyone was supposed to hate him and fear him, and he had weapons of mass destruction. Of course, he didn't. But you have to demonize the enemy in order to prepare the population for military escalation, for military conflict. That's exactly what's going on in North Korea and the U.S. North Korea is an educated population. It has a long life expectancy. It's a country that wants peace, that would like to be interactive with the rest of the world, and instead is treated as Iran is now or as Cuba has been for six decades, because they too had revolutions, as the ultimate demons. What we need is a change in the American government policy. We need to say, we meaning the U.S. people need to demand from the U.S. government, sign a peace treaty. Let's end the Korean War. It's been 60 years. Mm-hmm. End sanctions instead of targeting the people. Why deprive people of food and medicine as we did in Iraq? Does that really do anything except create the atmosphere, the precursor for actual military confrontation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sanctions just affect the people of the country, not the government. I mean, But what I continue to ask, even about Iran, about any country that really is a sovereign nation, I mean, why don't they have the right to develop nuclear weapons? Why is it only Western powers that can build up their nuclear arsenal? I just don't understand that contradiction.
And North Korea has the right to send satellites into space, which is why they were sanctioned in December. At the same time they sent up a satellite, which they have a right to do, India set off a nuclear test that day. North Korea is part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. India is not. Why have this double standard where North Korea is so demonized for doing what all countries want to do? 75-cent satellites up in 2012. North Korea was the only one that got a UN sanction. It's because the United States government is determined to overthrow that regime and put into place in North Korea what they have in South Korea, a proxy or a puppet government in this vital strategic area right on China's borders.
And why China? Why put the pressure on China? We have about a minute left.
Well, the United States sees China basically as a strategic competitor. Ultimately, I think the United States would like to overthrow the Chinese Communist government. They would like to be able to do to China what they have done to China in the past and what they've done to other countries, return them to a kind of a semi-colonial status so that the great vast resources and riches of the country can belong principally to Wall Street or to London or to Paris rather than to the Chinese people.
Absolutely. And when you see these joint U.S. and South Korean military exercises happening along the peninsula, it really has to ask, who's really threatening who in the region?
If North Korea was carrying out massive war games and staging the mock invasion of the United States along Long Island, people would be up in arms. That's what the U.S. and South Korea are doing today.
Absolutely.
To North Korea.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I think a lot of people fear North Korea because they don't understand it. It's a closed-off society in terms of the people there, and I think opening the dialogue, talking about it, and really understanding the complexities is very important. Thank you so much, Brian Becker, Director for the Answer Coalition.
Thanks.
So that's North Korea. It basically does not want to be bombed back into the Stone Age like Iraq, Iran, not Iran yet, hopefully, but I mean, you know, Iraq, Libya, you know, Yugoslavia, all these countries that have been destroyed by American imperialism, that did not have nuclear weapons, did not have the means to defend themselves against American imperialism, and they were flattened. North Korea doesn't want to suffer that fate. And you see, Venezuela was able to escape American invasion largely because it built a regional alliance. North Korea does not have that option of collective security. It has to arm itself to the teeth in order to defend itself to deter invasion. And you see, that's really what's going on. This is for self-defense. You know, North Korea isn't going to attack anyone. What it's trying to do is to protect itself in a very hostile environment. So that's really what's going on. But one of the things that, of course, like you might not know about is, and I found this story in Maoist Rebel News with Jason Unruh just the other day, Pirate Bay, which is the website that has been persecuted in the West, you know, for freely distributing various forms of software, has actually moved to North Korea. It's been given asylum, digital asylum in North Korea, of all places. And Jason Unruh is going to tell you all about that. You know, it's not exactly the story you would what you would expect, but here it is.
There is some excellent news. The Pirate Bay has given up trying to stay in Sweden because it can't. Basically because the US and its monopoly corporate establishment is trying to get the site shut down because of claimed infringement of copyright. So then the Pirate Bay has tried to go to two other locations, I believe Norway and Spain, to try to set up operations there to continue their service. However, they've been rejected there too. Thankfully, the Pirate Bay has found a new home in North Korea. That's right. The Pirate Bay, on their blog, says that they were contacted by the leader of North Korea and offered cyber amnesty, meaning the Pirate Bay, the infrastructure that makes up Pirate Bay, will now exist in North Korea under their protection, which means I would love to see the RIAA, or the Movie Industry Association of America, file a DMCA to North Korea. They will no doubt be laughed at. This is absolutely great news. The Pirate Bay has finally gone somewhere where capitalism, the Recording Industry Association of America, and the Recording Music Industry Recording Association of America can get them. which means now our downloading off of Pirate Bay has been protected. Of course, this does come with certain limitations. North Korea doesn't have that much bandwidth. But the fact is that service will now be available. This was announced on their blog. The logo for the Pirate Bay now includes a North Korean flag on the sails. Now, a lot of people are saying that this is like a hypocritical move, where it's ironic given North Korea's strict control of the internet. However, it's not ironic when you actually think about it. Us as Marxists don't believe in private property rights, meaning once something's created, it should be out there. We don't really believe in copyright. We believe that it actually holds back the potential of many people. So they've gone to a state that doesn't believe in private property. That sounds absolutely appropriate and actually what should happen. Now, obviously, a big part of this is North Korea giving a big FU to the United States and its capitalist system. But now that one of the things that they've been hounding after the most after all this time is now going to be protected by them. And that's certainly going to be a thorn in the side of the United States, and it's actually really going to get one over on them. They're going to be really mad about it, which is actually pretty funny when you think about it. So I would like to say thank you to North Korea for letting us continue to have the Pirate Bay, to keep letting us have that measure of freedom of exchange of information that capitalism otherwise wouldn't allow us to have.
Isn't that interesting, right? I mean, you have Pirate Bay that moves from Sweden to North Korea in order to get away from the persecution that's experienced in the capitalist system. You know, that's incredible, right? I mean, like, it's just like, you know, most people would not see that coming, but there it is, right? They have moved to a socialist country where there is no copyright. There is no such thing as copyright. You can have the free exchange of information, and that's permitted. Like, how about that? It's quite eye-opening, I'd say. So I want to end off the program with another update on the protest movement that's continuing in Quebec right now, that's been reignited by moves by the PQ government to reopen the whole issue of tuition fee increases. And once again, the students are not having it, and they're back out on the streets. So I'm going to end with this. So once again, a salute to Hugo Chavez. You will always be remembered as a revolutionary hero that you are. You've joined the same august company as Lenin, Ho Chi Minh, Mao Zedong, hell, all the way back to Cypselus of Corinth, the first revolutionary in ancient Greece. You're in good company. So solidarity. You'll always be remembered. You'll always be an inspiration. Thank you.
Well, Canadian students rally in Montreal to protest against the government's decision to raise tuition fees. Scores of protesters were arrested after police stepped in to disperse the crowds. Well, to discuss that a bit further, we're now joined by Joshua Blakeney, Press TV's correspondent, who is joining us now via Skype from Calgary. Joshua, thanks a lot for joining us now. What exactly is going on here? Because Parti Québécois had originally said that it would not be raising tuition fees.
Yes, it's the height of political cynicism, Waka. The Parti Québécois, which is headed by Pauline Marois, who's now the Premier of Quebec, rose to power on the back of the student protests that were ubiquitous throughout Canada, but which had an epicenter in Quebec in 2012. About this time last year, Quebec erupted in protest in response to the then government of Jean Charest, who had proposed tuition fee hikes, and Pauline Marois had pledged that she would not raise tuition fees, and she appears to have done a volte face. And the young people in Quebec are probably among the most politically conscious Canadians, because Quebec is a very politicized entity due to the questions revolving around separatism. And the students have taken to the streets en masse. They aren't partisan. They're not going to allow the Parti Québécois off the hook just because they're more aligned with the separatist aspirations of certain people in Quebec. A promise was made, and the students are saying they're feeling very let down. I think there is a perception that, that whichever political party is in power in Quebec, that they're more aligned with the well-heeled in Quebec society, more aligned with the capitalists in Quebec society, who obviously benefit from having students coming out of university with tens of thousands of dollars of debt around their shoulders, because then when they get into corporations, they won't put their head above the parapet, they won't question their bosses, they won't defy the dictates of their superiors, because they need to have their job to pay their debts off. So we see this system in Western capitalist society these days of debt slavery, of young people being in tens of thousands of dollars of debt. And, you know, I think the students would say, although the proposed tuition fee hikes are more modest comparatively when compared with the hikes proposed by the Charest government, that it's a slippery slope. And I often remind Press TV viewers that, you know, Canada has got the second largest uranium reserves in the world, the third largest oil reserves in the world. In Quebec, it's well known as a place where hydroelectric power is generated in a great quantities. And the young people are saying, look, where are these profits going? Is society going to be so undemocratic that all the wealth just goes to 1% of society and working class people either have to choose to have no education because they can't afford it, or to get into tens of thousands of dollars of debt? Now, we also see a rather draconian aspect of this, and the media in Canada has been uncritically reporting the fact that the police have been declaring these protests illegal protests, which contradicts the Canadian Constitution, which is the supreme law of Canada, which was enshrined in 1982, which protects the rights of people in Canada to assemble, to have freedom of speech. So we see an attack on democratic rights being used, well, these protests being used by authoritarian politicians. And
Joshua, I do apologize for having to interrupt you, but we will have to leave it there for now. But of course, we do appreciate your insight. That was Joshua Blakeney, Press TV's correspondent, speaking to us live from Calgary.
Pour le monde, je veux pas savoir d'où ils viennent. Je veux savoir où ils vont. Le monde, ils peuvent être blanc, jaune, noir, mauve, bleu, avec des pitons en orange. M'en calisse. M'en calisse. S'ils veulent se battre avec moi, c'est mes frères. Alors, on n'est pas des racistes. Il faut arrêter de toujours s'excuser. Le problème est bien simple. Le Québec, c'est un pays conquis et annexé par la force. T'es conquis par la force des armes en 1760, puis annexé par la force avec l'acte d'union en 1840. La Confédération, c'est juste la suite de l'acte d'union. Donc le peuple québécois est un peuple soumis, un peuple vassalisé, un peuple inféodé à un autre.
C'est le Dibala, Napa, Kong qui font face au Canada.
Génocide, pas qu'un décès ou décès, chaque coup de
l'appellation.
Attention, on va mettre la pression.
C'est plus que la pression.
On met la question, non l'agression.
Pour caler l'agression.
Vous parlez la pression.
Même si on se fait chier, chicane le con.
Sur la tuque, le nuque, syllable mégatique, dans ta tête, tuque, t'es dingue, nuque, yo. Moi j'étais toujours, mettais ta babino, but qui est pas gros, me coiffe de mes idiots. Bif d'un trait blanc, bleu, l'horreur d'un siècle sans que ni quête ou l'erreur fut inhumaine, nous mène en deçà d'un humanisme à redire. Si c'est pour mettre des grands yeux, mon mec, penche mon sable, m'ancre dans cet ancien, c'est sans appartenance, vieux, yo. Pas de transcendance, ceux et celles, tous ces gens qui s'allègent de leur allégeance, allégant l'urgence de l'amour immense, l'imminence des grands ensembles et sans racine dans l'errance pour vivre là. Qui a toutes et toutes les apparences. Un totalitarisme en essence. Qui fait des particularismes nuisants. De moi un terroriste en puissance.
Quand je prends le cas,
la résistance.
Attention, on va maintenir la pression.
C'est plus que la pression.
On met la question, sinon la régression.
Pour caler l'agression.
Vous parlez la pression.
Même si on se fait chier, chicane le con.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, 250 watt of community power.
In Canada, suicide is the second leading cause of death among youth aged 15 to 24. The majority of people who attempt suicide are not sure they want to die, but an overwhelming feeling of hopelessness and lack of support contribute to